are listening to the Elephant in the Room podcast with your host, Sutta Singh. Each week, we will bring you a diverse range of inspiring speakers on issues of inequality and inequity. You will hear stories about fairness, justice, belonging, and about best practice for creating a more inclusive workplace. So, if you are an individual or leader interested in a fairer, equitable, compassionate society and workplace, this podcast is for you.
My guest on today's show is Barbara Phillips, Chair of the Race and Ethnicity Equity Board and Board Member of the PRCA. Barbara is an experienced transformation and strategic communications leader and an accredited member of the Society of Mediators with a specialism in workplace and employee mediation. Barbara's experience is based around high-profile global brands within the FTSE 100. She has volunteered with community groups for over 20 years and is currently a sitting magistrate and an advisory board member for an education social enterprise. Hey, Barbara, welcome to the show. To start off, tell us something about your background. How did you get into communications?
Well, thank you very much, first of all, Sudha, for having me onto this podcast today. It's really, really glad to be here. Let me see about my background. I think that's relevant to what we're talking about today. And this is also a lesson for young people that English was always my best subject. English, poetry, story writing, storytelling, telling jokes, being a bit of a family comedian, just being, you know, a communicator, which I don't think children are acknowledged when they're young, but, you know, lucky for me, it's been my career. So I'd say I wasn't necessarily an attention seeker, but I always loved to listen and tell stories and tell jokes, and I loved poetry, which wasn't very cool. So I'd say that, you know, being in communications now absolutely is where I think I should be.
Brilliant. And I think it's a great thing that you liked poetry. It's one of the redeeming things about life and our times. How has your identity shaped your personal and professional journey?
I'd say that I didn't think it did specifically. When I left home and growing up, if you're coming from your family environment and at school, you don't think it does particularly. I think that corporate UK kind of shaped my career. You know, being a black woman, as soon as you walk in the door, before anything else about you, that's what's spotted first. And with that come several ideas of what you may or may not be. I was brought up with the belief that everybody is equal. Wherever you come from, everyone is equal. Everyone has the same purpose in life, so to speak. Certainly from a physiological point of view, our heart beats, we need our kidneys. So I think my identity has always been pushed against someone telling me that I wasn't as good as, or I was inferior, because I was like, no, actually, we're all exactly the same. And I think that has been with me since I left school and since I went to university and all the different roles I've had. And even in the voluntary sector where we've had to push against racism, my identity definitely being that no one is better than anyone else as a starting point. You get better people in terms of more integrity or kinder or more generous, but those are personality traits. But you can't just walk into a room as a black woman and stand next to a white woman and the white woman automatically be better than me. That's the way I was brought up. So I think that's had an impact on everything I do, because, you know, I refuse to take, you better step back. When I was growing up a long time ago, it was white's all right, back, stand back. You know, it was that kind of nonsense. So
awful. But you were lucky to have parents and family who helped to shape how you think about who you are, because I think that's so critical. The family telling you firmly that we are all equal, because that's what the reality is.
Exactly. I've spoken about it before. It's also been a hindrance because I refuse to just kowtow for the sake of it. Don't get me wrong. We're all brought up, especially for a certain age, heavily on the manners and politeness and having respect for older people and authority. That's all lovely, but I'm not just going to do that. You have to earn it. I'm not just going to let you trample on me because you're my line manager. Doesn't make you any better than me. So
that's,
you're
great.
With that upbringing, it's interesting because I only can say that now. At the time, it was just everyone's the same. Go out and do what you need to do. But remember, everybody is the same. And that's literally all the advice I got. And that's pretty much, I think, all you need to know, that irrespective of what anyone says to you, You don't have to believe it. If somebody puts that label on you, you don't have to accept it. And I think there's a whole generation, and maybe generations now, that feel they have to accept it. And I think from my generation, I was one of the few people who didn't feel I had to accept it because you told me I was X. And a lot of people my age just accepted it and thought, okay, I can't go any further because this time X.
Yeah, that's a great point, Barbara, that we don't need to accept labels that other people put on us. What for you is the elephant in the room?
It's only ever going to be race, you know. I think it's not only race, because we've got past race, because we've said the R word. I think right now what we're experiencing is the people who subscribe to it. And the US elections, 74 million people voted for Donald Trump. They've had 4 years to see what he's about. And they still think, yep, that works for me. Let me tick his name. So I think the elephant in the room right now is the fact that people like race, they subscribe to all the white supremacy, it works for them, it's a status quo. And there are people probably secretly who are quite happy to keep it going. I think that's the elephant in the room. And this is why our struggle in Reeve is going to be a lot. We have a nice cozy start, and I think we've had a honeymoon period, but I think the work starts now when people start saying, well, no, actually, I don't want to change. I like it the way it is. And people want to keep the status quo, even with all the knowledge. Even with everything that's out there, there's still powerful people who think, well, that's nice, but I like it the way it is.
There's no reason why people in power should want to dismantle something that has worked so well for them, even if it means excluding a huge part of the population from their right to equal opportunity. Since you've already touched on REEB, as chair of REEB and a board member of the PRCA, what are the priorities that you have set for yourself?
We wrote those terms of reference. So everyone on REEB, we all joined together. And I love the way it's all kind of open. That's why I like to be in an organization and a group, that everyone's voice is valid. My priority is working my way through that list. So I'm going to be pushing to make sure everything on that list is executed and done and delivered. And I think my strength is that I don't need to be popular. I have no interest in being popular. Respect is great. You don't have to like me, because that's not what I'm here for. So my priorities is working through that list and letting people on the board, PRCA specifically, letting them know that I see them. I see the ones who are silent. I see the ones who have said nothing. They haven't, you know, said anything against us, but they haven't supported us either. This is not like diversity and inclusion, where there's a broad range of things and you can kind of pick what you want to support. This is why we focused on race with us. There's only one thing, and it's race.
Absolutely. So, this is non-negotiable. And I must congratulate you on the manner in which you've set out what REEB is going to do, because it's very, very clear on what the terms of reference are and what you're trying to achieve. There's no ambiguity around that, and that's an incredible thing. So well done on structures and pushing through lists. That's the way to get things done. And congratulations again on the recent launch of the Ethnicity Pay Gap Report. Tell us more about it. What are you hoping to achieve with the launch of the report?
I think as a board, we owe it to members and all practitioners of colour, really, in our industry, to say, we know this is going to take time. We know that people aren't going to just flip overnight. But while all this is going on, while you're still enduring microaggression, still being left out of succession planning, but while all that's happening, you may as well get the same pay.
Yeah.
So the point was, while so many things are going on, it's not going to be chronological. You know, it's not going to be, okay, number five on our list, next. It's going to happen in all different time frames. You know, some things will happen quickly. Some things will may take years. So the very least we can do is pay us the same as our white counterparts. So that was why it had to be first, because it's a complicated process. Lots of other things can happen. You can still change your culture. You can still be more diverse. You can still recruit more people. You can still the point is, putting that out first means when you do something, when you look at recruitment, you look at retention, you're now you're going to have to look at pay.
It's indefensible that in today's day and age, we have to talk about this. So it's great that REEB has taken up the agenda, and with your report, you've set the right tone, and hopefully the industry should endorse it.
We have our open Q&A session on the 18th of November, where our guide expert is going to be available to answer questions. But even then, there'll be people who just won't be engaging. And I think, you know, there's some work to be done there. And I'm happy to do it, as I say, because I'm not looking to be popular at all. This is too important. This is not about us, not about our egos. This is about, you know, getting some basics.
So. Absolutely. It is about fairness and inequality. And it is the right thing to do. And there is no need to procrastinate on this issue anymore.
Agreed.
What, according to you, are the biggest entry barriers for people of color in the industry? And what would your advice be on three things that agencies can do to address this issue?
I think, first of all, it is visibility in terms of people of color, women as well, because there's a lot of women in PR, but not a lot of senior women in PR. So whichever way you cut and dice it, there's hardly any men of colour in PR. So I think it's visibility and role models. And even though we have organisations now who have started mentoring and they've been doing it for a year or two, and that's all very good, the barrier is definitely, number one, visibility and representation. Two, there is this uncertainty of whether you're going to be paid the same. And people will tell you, I know I'm being paid less than X. So that's off-putting, because you've got to be 10 times better to get half the amount of money. I mean, it doesn't seem like a good deal to me. So there's a, and then I think thirdly, it's not terribly appetizing. Internal comms is slightly different because you're in with the culture of the organization and the brand. So you have an opportunity to maybe associate yourself and match up your values with maybe the brand of the organization. Then you work in their communications department internally, even doing PR internally, there's an aspect of it that you might already know and recognise because it's a well-known brand. But with agencies, it's different. It's kind of a subculture of its own. It can be run and set up any way that managing partners decide. And I think that's actually quite intimidating because you'll see a sea of white faces. You'll see stuff that comes out. Lots of agencies produce material that is so tone deaf. And you think, oh, I wouldn't want to work there, because it's going to be really embarrassing for me, or I'm going to have to be, spend all my time fighting, you know, to get a bit of recognition or just to stop the stereotyping. It's not terribly appetizing for, you know, young people of color right now. I think all of the kind of the cultural disparities and the exclusion just puts people off. So things to do. That's always a tough one. I mean, if you can find yourself a mentor, there are mentor groups out there. Find yourself a mentor, definitely, and think really hard about career path. We should put ourselves on that path and make sure, you know, what are the next two or three steps? What's your ultimate aim? Do you want to be CEO? Do you want to be account director? Or do you want to be a managing partner? I don't think we do enough of that. We just say, oh, great, thanks for giving me the job, and I hope it's the same money as my white counterpart. The agency, they need to stop being performative. Even if you're in an agency now and it's all white, that's fine, because you can still be an ally, you can still be supportive, and you can still have a non-toxic culture. But really, if you're in a London, there is no excuse for not having a diverse workforce, because London is like the most diverse city in the UK, one of the most diverse in Europe. And this is what I've said forever, you need to look at their culture, because, you know, I don't want young people of colour to go into any more of those organisations that are so toxic and that damages them. And either they can't stay in communications, or they won't go back to another agency, so they go and do something else entirely because it's so damaging. So I think they need to look at their culture. And don't tell me, agencies, that you don't know what good culture looks like. Don't tell me that you don't know what inclusive culture looks like. There's enough material out there. The leaders know. So they just haven't chosen to do it. So I think they need to make their agencies and environment more inclusive, more inviting, make it psychologically safe for everyone, and the talent will come.
Some great points there, Barbara. Do you think legislation on targets will help move the agenda?
Well, we had the last Race Equality Act, it was 2010, wasn't it? So public sector, possibly, because you're close to government and there's some sort of regulation. Private sector, no. I don't think targets will work, because people will just, private sector, in particular agencies, will just ignore them and they'll just double down. But there should be sanctions. There should be some sort of sanction whereby, you know, you ever get an extra tax. Or I don't know, I'm not a financial person, but I know your operating model certainly shouldn't be deemed to be fit for purpose if the culture is toxic in a and a non-inclusive way. It should damage your reputation. But targets, I say no, because it'll just make people double down.
Very interesting point of view, Barbara. From there, let's move to this question on Black Lives Matter. COVID-19 has shone the spotlight on racial inequalities and has organizations scrambling to display their inclusive credentials. Do you think it'll move the needle on equity and inclusion for people of color, or is this just a temporary response?
I think it will, but I don't think it will happen immediately. Even though I don't agree with it, I still think that people of colour have a huge role to play. I don't think we should be leading it. We should be paving a way and shining a spotlight on what needs to be done. And organisations like Reeve and lots of independent contractors like yourself, myself and consultants will help them. So, yes, I think it's different this time because we have a lot more white people saying this is not acceptable. I mean, black people and Asian people and everybody have been saying it's not acceptable forever. But there weren't enough of them, either in power or influential enough. What's different this time than any other time is that, one, it's global, and there are enough numbers of people who aren't black and Asian, who aren't ethnically diverse, saying. And then if you marry that with what's physically happening in populations of the world, this is what organisations and big agencies and big firms are realising now. When they look to their five-year projections, who's going to be available for talent and who are going to be their customers? They're not going to be all white. And if they don't make a pivot right now, they're not going to have anyone to sell to, and there'll be no one to work in the organisations. And I think that's only a realisation this year. So I think it will be different. I don't think it'll be easy and I don't think it'll be quick, but I do feel something's going to happen. I think there has been a shift.
I guess that there is a huge impetus from society at large and from people who are there up with the status quo. Should PR advisors be telling clients to be more inclusive? Is it our role?
I think that if we go back to the basics of my PR book 25 years ago, back in the day, it was your relationship with your publics and it was mainly external. I think from that context, you should say to do that, you need to be inclusive because publics don't look the way they used to. And, you know, there's some nuances from different communities or groups that you should be aware of if you want to have a good relationship. So in that context, yes, we absolutely should be saying the best way to get, you know, have a good relationship with your customers who are Asian is to do X. And this is what I've been saying. To sustain your business, you need the talent, you need the infrastructure, and you need the customers. If you don't make that inclusive all the way through, then you're not going to have much of a business. Give it, you know, 5 years' time, you're not going to have much of a business because, you know, the people involved in those activities are changing.
That's so true. What would your advice be to young people who are thinking of entering the industry? Younger people today are more conscious about things and are looking, want a fairer and more inclusive world. And while race and ethnicity is going to continue to be issues, how young people deal with those issues is different from how this generation has done. So what would your advice be to them?
I welcome young people to get involved in the broader communications industries because it's for them to tell their stories. You know, the way that my nephews and nieces portray their stories are different to how I would because I'm not, you know, of that generation. So they should get involved so their stories are told accurately in a way that appeals to them. What's great about young people is they are not going to put up with the amount of nonsense that we did. They do deal with race in a different way. But generally, I think young people have come together an awful lot more. They've absorbed each other's cultures. They're more homogenous in a good way. So I'd say to them, keep on doing what they're doing in terms of they've identified how, you know, things should be. They're being quite clear how they think society can be. But then I think they should come and have their stories told. And they're very good at that.
That's great. I have to ask you this because the industry is seized with this issue, especially people who are working on race, equity and inclusion issues. What is your view on this category called BAME? How would we address it? What is your view on this?
Well, I've said torch BAME, and that's been my position forever. Just torch the whole saying and go back to identifying people as they are. I think what probably needs to happen, because when we were working with our ethnicity pay gap expert, we looked at classifications. A lot of them do come from the government. And I think it's time the government did another survey and another classification of how people identify, because I think it's a lot more complex. And I think you should finally say, because if you use BAME, that means we can't talk about Asian community on its own. That offends me because it oversimplifies, because all BAME says is other. It's white is the center of the universe and everything else is just, you know, revolving around it and it's other. So I think that even if it takes you 3 seconds more to write out the word black and Asian, and I think you need to write it out, because we're talking about different experiences. We use we use black, Asian and ethnically diverse. I'm sorry, their life experience is going to be different to mine. So let's not lump them together. And I don't say that I've got an answer, but right now I think we should just spread them all out, write them all separately. There are occasions where we can just write Asians. There are occasions where you can just write black. There are occasions where you can just write ethnically diverse. We don't always have to be lumped together because we have different experiences. And I think it's that we have to give ourselves permission to say, I'm just talking about Asians now, or I'm just talking about black people now. That's all fine. It's not to the detriment of each other. You're actually highlighting different lived experience. Yes, there will be universalities, but that's human universalities, or that's living in the UK universalities. And I think we should just, for now, call everything by its name, call groups by their actual name until we've come up with something better. If not, take the extra few seconds and just write out the words separately and know they mean separate things.
Absolutely. So we come to the last question. What drives you every day? Where do you find your purpose?
I think going back to my childhood of this, you know, everybody's equal. And I hate it when people aren't treated fairly. That's from an old person in the street, that's somebody I don't know. You know, I just can't bear it. It's in my blood. I can't bear, which is probably why I'm a magistrate. I can't bear people being treated unfairly based on nothing more than either someone's prejudice or someone's stereotyping. It just doesn't sit well with me. If there's evidence and it's clear evidence, fine, that's a different story. So what drives me is that as human beings, we can just do so much better. You know, I'm not saying feed the world, kumbaya, world peace. I'm just saying we can do so much better. And each as an individual in your environment, you know, there's something you can do every day to make someone's environment, not necessarily yours, someone's environment a little bit better. And it drives me knowing that it's really great. You get something out of it yourself, which is why I've done so much voluntary work, because you gain from that. And I'm just driven by that need to do better and for it to be fairer. You know, people underestimate fairness. That's just the bedrock of everything. Just keep it fair. And the people who will rise. And the people that will sink. But let's start off. Let's let it all be at least from a fair starting point. I think that's what drives me.
Awesome. That's so good to hear. Because how difficult is it for people to be fair? You really think that it shouldn't be that difficult. This is what you learn as you grow up. And these are the values that you inculcate. So
exactly. Basic values, human values, you know, that goes across all nations, all nationalities, all races, fairness.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Barbara. It's been such an interesting conversation and time has just flown.
Thank you. It has. Thank you so much for that. I appreciate it. Lovely to speak with you.
Lovely to speak with you too.
Thank you for joining us this week on the Elephant in the Room podcast. Don't forget to subscribe to the show on any of your favorite platforms, iTunes, Spotify, Google Podcasts. And if you enjoyed listening to the podcast today, don't forget to write a review and tell your friends. Sign up on the link in the show notes to receive updates on our guest speakers, blogs, and events. And don't forget to tune in every Thursday for new episodes.